Welcome to the Best of Times podcast. My name's John Doran. Over the coming months, I'm going to be talking to people about some of the best and worst times they've been through and hopefully find out how these experiences have made them who they are today. In episode one, I talked to Jason Williamson. Jason is one half of the electronic punk band Sleaford Mods, along with Andrew Fern. Jason started making music as Sleaford Mods in 2007, just in time for the banking crisis, and they went on to capture the zeitgeist as it exists at street level. Sleaford Mods have become the true poet laureates of broken, austerity, Brexit Britain. They are just about to release their 11th album, Eaten Alive. Jason, tell us about the best of times.
Best of times were, I would imagine, the release of Divide and Exit. I think it was 2014. Austerity Dogs had come the year before, and it started to lift the band, and we felt like something was happening. Divide and Exit came out, and it just kicked off, really, but in a positively, sort of critical recognition way, not fame, but for us it was kind of a fame thing as well. It was both of the things together. It was quite a magical time. The recording of it, everything about that album. Running up, recording it every night after work, having to do it four or five nights a week, up until 2 a.m, going home, getting a shower, getting in bed, getting up for 6 to go to work again. It was great, It was what I personally had, psychologically trained myself for, over the years, keeping myself boom, in the mix of it. And with Andrew as well, he'd come into his own with the music, and I wasn't having to sort of sit there and say, I want this. He'd just come up with it, and created this this style of music that that fit the idea. So when that kicked off, it was quite magical. Reviews. Mark Fisher reviewed it in I think it was Wire magazine, and that kind of blew me away, really. Just stuff like that, really. There was a lot of good stuff. Stuart Lee turning up to gigs. I mean, I'm not a fan of not outwardly fan of Stuart Lee or Mark Fisher or any of them, but they're obviously integral people, and for them to turn up and say good things and write good things about it was quite something, In fact, anyone that does that, it's just brilliant. But yeah, so It kicked off, and people were coming to the gigs. The gigs were selling out.
Was there one particular... Do you remember one particular event where it really stopped you in your tracks and made you think, oh, shit, something's actually going to happen now?
Yeah, I think it was the gig in London, the place on Denmark Street that's closed down now. Also, I forgot what it's called. Oh, well, it's been knocked down, actually.
The 12 Bar.
Yeah, that's it. We got in there and it was rammed. Stuart Lee was there, as I said. A few other people were there. And there were people at the front. One guy was virtually crying and thanking, who I imagine was, he was praying to, the Lord or whatever. Thank God they're here. And he didn't necessarily mean we were here. It was like someone was here.
Yeah.
I thought that was really quite something. And it was a lot to handle, really, to take in. It quite freaked me out,
So we're sat here today, it's Thursday morning. Neither of us are at work.
No.
You're wearing nice clothes or
and
whatever.
Yourself, mate.
Oh, thank
yourself.
You.
It's okay.
But the thing is, I don't think either of us, we're not rich, are we?
No.
So... when success or recognition came for you, if it didn't come financially, what were the benefits?
It was just the fingers up to all the people that thought I was, an idiot, really. I mean, it was a real payback. That I got a lot of satisfaction out of, to be honest. And I still do, People still, try to have a pop occasionally, but, they just can't do it, It's just, it's impossible. You've just got no case at all. Get out. Get out of court, sir. in that sense, it was great. But everything else was, you know, it was not really, I didn't really get, you know, initially I did, you know, a bit more money going to town, I'll buy whatever and not have to worry about it. And I don't have to worry about the mortgage, you know, and good food and all that. But no, it just wasn't, it really didn't mean a lot after, you know, a very short period of time, you know what I mean?
So I'm guessing there hasn't been an artist in all of history who hasn't said at the beginning of their career, recognition and success isn't going to change me. But then, you know, the good reviews start pouring
in.
And
sure.
The next thing you know, you're doing a treble album or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you build a fortress? You know, how did you essentially say, we're never going to do a Sandinista? How did you build a fortress around what the essence of Sleaford Mods is?
Well, I don't know, because I think, you know, what I have realised is, you know, when you're coming up and you've got this sound that captures a lot of people's imagination and you're like, I'm never going to turn out to be like that, that and that. It's like, whoa. You know, it's a little bit of a tightrope, you know what I mean? And I don't think I've built that fortress, to be honest, you know.
Right.
I think as you get on through the industry, your tastes change, your ideas change. You don't want to keep doing Austerity Dogs or Divide and Exit. That's just not an option because it's creatively, it's just boring, you know. And so you move on. So where do you move from there, you know? And
it's, but you've not had Will I Am on a track.
No, very true. But, you know, I do worry that, you know, especially with this new album and the last album, you know, it's more of an accessible sound, perhaps. But what can you do, you know? I think that's just me and my own stupid paranoia, perhaps, you know.
Okay, Jason, tell me about the worst of times.
The worst of times were Divide and Exit 2014. I think, you know... It had become quite apparent to both myself and my wife that I needed to cut out some of my habits, so to speak. I wasn't, you know, an alcoholic or a drug addict as such, but I did use them a lot to kind of ward off any kind of responsibility to just get myself together and move forward with my life, you know. It started to come on top around that time, and I didn't stop, I just carried on and it just got worse, and touring became just a series of caves that I would, you know, fall into, put my stuff on the side and just take drugs, you know, and drink, and I was pretty miserable, to be honest, you know. I think it was a mixture of guilt and obviously everything else that had gone before that I needed to attend to from previous years, you know, etc. So, yeah, it was pretty bleak.
So, like, you and I are sort of like slightly different on this score. You know, I'm a chronic alcoholic. And
yes.
I have to abstain, like, properly from drink. I'll never drink again because I can't.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'm similar when it comes down to white drugs. I just have to not do them because it just ruins everything.
Yes, yeah.
How do you maintain your edge? And is being in Sleaford Mods hard to... Does it make it hard for you to maintain an edge?
No, it's easier, actually. I didn't think it would be, but it is. I mean, I've been 3 years without drink or drugs now, so... It's a lot easier, especially over the last 6 months. I've just begun to feel a lot more confident and a lot more happier, if that's a word or even a concept, a lot more steadier. It's easier. I think previous characteristics that led me into using these two things as a get-out clause, you know, sort of experiences, beliefs and all negative stuff that happened, is it comes on top when you're sober and you have to deal with that. So I had a bit of psychotherapy for about 18 months, and that helped me prepare for that in a sober sort of environment. But yeah, that fucks you up a bit. I mean, it's not a nice industry to be in as well sometimes, you know.
It's difficult because it's geared towards socialising, isn't it? You know? And I certainly, up until the time I stopped, I was often, and could be if I wanted to, out every single night till 4 a.m.
Oh, God, yeah.
So what did you replace that kind of social aspect of your life with?
At the gym. I became addicted to lifting weights, you know, and it fucked with me, because it's like, you don't do that. Nobody does that. In the world of music, you know, looking after yourself is, you know, it's looked down upon, isn't it? It's just No, you don't do that. What are you doing that for? You know, what are you drinking water for? So it fucked with me for a while, but I got over it and I just do it. I just accepted that is what I do, you know. And I still haven't got to the point where I'm, you know, doing videos in the gym and putting that on Instagram, but it might come.
Yeah.
but yeah, it's that and nicotine tablets, which I've still got to shake off. My family, my kids and my wife, you know, and just trying to adjust to that, which I have done. You know, it's things are really good. You know, I'm really lucky in that sense, because a lot of people, as you well know, don't. When you get to our time, I don't know how old you are. I'm 48, but
I'm 48 this year.
You know, you tend not to change past. You know,
it's frightening, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, you know, it's really hard for people to change, and I know a lot of people who were like me, who were still the old me. You know, struggling with that. A couple of them have managed to pull themselves through, but it's a bleak existence. You know, but. I'm lucky in the sense that it happened at a time when the career that I've always wanted took off, and I managed to pull myself through. You know what I mean?
I guess what I want people to know is that, like, it's really good if you need to stop drinking and doing drugs. That's really good.
Yeah.
But it's only the first 5% of it, and all the really hard stuff comes afterwards. Like, all the stuff you've been using drink and drugs to ignore.
Exactly.
You have to mend all of that stuff as well.
Yes.
And I've got a feeling I'm going to be attending to this stuff for the rest of my life.
Yes.
But as long as it gets incrementally easier with every passing year, maybe that's okay.
It's a win-win, I think. You know, I mean, it's dealing with that stuff, and I no longer feel guilty anymore about anything. But I sometimes get kidnapped by myself and revert back to that old person of complete unreason, of paranoia, of aggression, blame, and so, as you said, you know, it's dealing with that really on a day to day.
Was there a specific incident that made you come to your senses? Like, you know, I guess, like, in AA, they would call it, you know, reaching your bottom or whatever.
Yeah, there were. I mean, what happened was, it was just like another 2-day binge, sniff binge, you know. And I spent about 600, 700 quid and loads of beer, and got home, and my wife had moved out with my daughter and my son, Beau, who was just born, and she was staying in a hotel for a week. And I was there on my own, you know. I thought about getting more drugs in. I didn't bother. And then went to the shop, got more booze. And then for 2 nights did that, and, you know, more roll-ups, cigarettes, blah, blah, blah. And in the end, I just looked at this can of Star Prime and just thought, oh, fuck this, and that was it. There was loads of catastrophes, real bad catastrophes, but the last one was a really good drug binge that I still think about and think, you know, you still take yourself back to certain times, I'm sure you do, where you go, oh, fucking hell, yeah. Oh, yeah, I could just draw, ooh, I could do that. Oh, yeah. And you constantly think about that. I think about that last time in the sense of what I'd do better this time, you know. I wouldn't go to that pub. I'd just go home and do this. Then I'd go to the pub afterwards and I'd buy more drugs, you know. I wouldn't necessarily go to that person's house. I'd stay there because that means that I could stay up for longer. You know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And So I just had to stop, and my wife was just like, I'm going to have to leave you if this carries on anymore. You know, this is, I'm just going to have to take charge here, and because you know, and I just kept thinking, well, I don't want my kids growing up, because I think my daughter experienced some of it anyway. You know, and I worry sometimes that will you know, stay with her. My son, perhaps not. Who knows? But you know, I didn't want to be that person that when your kids grow up. You know,
do you think this kind of these flashpoints? Do you think you would have handled things even worse if you had have kind of achieved kind of a certain level of fame in your 20s?
Oh God, yeah, completely. Yeah. I wasn't formed whatsoever. I mean, I could go to work. I could go from job to job and keep myself in employment. But I was nasty, really nasty. Just completely reckless and borrowing money off my parents. You know, my mum went into debt because of my drug habits, you know what I mean, which she's still paying back, you know, really bad stuff. It would have been really bad. I think I would have completely lost it, because, you know, when I got there with Sleafy, it was like, oh, this is brilliant, I don't have to get drugs on the tick anymore, you know. I don't have to worry about going to the bank and going, oh, fucking hell, you know, is it going to give me anything? So imagine that at 20 odd.
Yeah.
Forget it. Forget it.
Yeah. So, like, my full routine, if I'm thinking about, I try and think about these things holistically, you know, and for me, it's all the same thing. The exercise is as important as the psychotherapy, as important as my diet,
yes,
as important,
yes, yes,
as going to bed early,
yeah,
and
yeah,
not having too much coffee or whatever. Mm. So my routine is, like, got to watch the caffeine, no processed sugar, no sweets or anything like that, mm-hmm, no cake. You replaced alcohol with going to the gym. I replaced it with cake. I made the wrong choice. You
well,
know.
I did replace it with cake as well. Yeah. I had cake every day. I love cake.
It's amazing.
Oh,
isn't it?
Oh God, yeah. It was. And you know, it got to a point where I'd bake them as well. You know. And,
yeah, I still do it with bacon.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, but yeah, well, I mean, in the sense of baking cakes, not bacon.
Oh, bake, right, bacon. Yeah. Oh, you were baking your own cakes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
It's quite hardcore, isn't it?
Yes, big time, you know.
You've got to make sure there's a cake that. How's the only way you know there's going to be a cake that you've got to make it yourself?
Oh, buttercream and, it got. But now I've eased off that, but coffee is still a bad news, and I'll never go to bed much before 12.
How often do you exercise?
Every day if I can. With the kids, it's hard. If Bo's off, because he does nursery 3 days a week, so he's off for the rest of it. So me and my wife's at home as well. So we you know, I can't really get out when he's off, you know what I mean? Because he's a real handful at the minute, you know. So
I got ill over winter and I kind of stopped going swimming for about 2.5 months. I'm only just starting again now. And it's amazing how much it affects you when you stop, isn't it?
Yes, and that's what I worry about. I think, well, you know, it's exercise. The minute you stop, you get really grumpy, and it's like, well, you have just replaced it for something else. Although, you know, obviously the gym isn't, you know, four bags of coke in a horrible smoke-filled room, is it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not. But yeah, you do. What can you do, you know?
Is there anything else you use to keep your mental health on track other than the, you know, the exercise? And you said you've done psychotherapy.
Yeah.
You're kind of done with that now?
Or? Yeah, I am, yeah. I don't think I need to go back, you know. I thought about going back when I left, I had a couple of dips, and I thought, you know, being really aggressive all the time and stuff. You have to think about why you lost the plot, and you have to watch yourself every time that happens. I mean, this morning I lost the plot because my son was screaming, you know, and it was just too much. And it's just trying to check yourself around that. Other than that, I don't think I really need to go back. I think I've talked about all I need to talk about, and I think I've, you know, navigated my way through these issues, these subjects, and I now... have you know, taken them out of myself and put them on the table, and I can look at them now instead of them just, you know, sort of
hit them with a shoe.
Yeah, basically, yeah, you know, they're no longer on the top of my head, you know what I mean?
How have these really good and really bad experiences for you as a musician mm-hmm. kind of fed into who you are as an artist today? Like, specifically, I'm guessing, like, what lessons did you learn when it came time to record your brilliant new album, Eaten Alive?
Thank you. I don't know. I mean, before it was all laced with cynicism, negativity. I mean, it still is, you know. You know, there's a lot of naivety in there, or, you know, unreasonable critiques, perhaps. But I like all that, and why shouldn't you, you know, paranoia, experience, grudges. These have all moved into the new album, but in a calmer way, a bit more of an intelligent way, you know. They're not so on top, they're not so direct. Kind of sat back a little bit more, you know. But I don't think the main nucleus of it has changed, really, you know. But I don't know.
So why have you moved on from Rough Trade?
I was told that it was... we didn't need to be with them. It was... We were independent before, so we could go back to that. We could operate independently with the same infrastructure and, you know, carry on the level we're at, you know. But that didn't happen, and it just went like that. Woo. So the album announcement was made, and then it just ran out of petrol, and I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. So the infrastructure wasn't there, so we've had to get everything, we've had to learn how to do all of that in a month, you know, which I think we pulled the campaign up to speed with it, but it was a premature move, you know. Yeah. I think if I'd have gone back to that decision where I went, okay, we'll leave, I would have said no now, but we're here now, and we can't really help that, and... just got to make the best of what it is, you know. I mean, the album's great. I'm really happy with it, you know what I mean? You know, it's not shit yet. It's still interesting. So,
yeah. So on Kebab Spider, you know, you are taking a kind of a pop at, like, a past it, fake kind of successful rock star kind of figure.
Yeah, Graham Coxon is the one on Flipside where I talk about Graham Coxon looks like a left-wing Boris Johnson. And and if you listen to me, I've got absolutely nothing against you whatsoever. It wasn't a personal attack. It's just like, oh, yes. It comes across like that, doesn't it? So that's why I said that. On Kebab Spider, it was more, you know... certain people from bands that have been around for God knows how many years on album campaigns that, you know, try to act integrally political. And it's again, going back to this naivety thing, this unreasonable critique thing, it's like, well, you're nowhere near anybody that does minimum wage jobs. You might be. You might live next door to someone like that, but you've not done that for a long time. So I really don't think you can talk about it the way you do, you know.
Do you worry that, like, say, if you earn a bit more money than you earn now, say if you went up a tax bracket,
yeah,
would that put you out of the position where you're allowed to talk about this stuff?
Yeah, probably would, but I think I'm kind of there now, you know what I mean? I certainly pay a lot more tax than I did before.
Yeah.
So...
Is it more about paying your dues then?
I think it's paying your dues, and I still feel very close to that experience of, you know, because I did 20 plus years of it. I left school and went straight into it, bar 2 years doing A-levels, you know what I mean? And so I still feel very close to that. I wouldn't imagine for a minute that in 3 years' time I'd probably be talking about the same stuff. I don't know, by then I would have moved away from that fully, but I still think Eaten Alive is part of a series of albums that is connected to that, you know.
When I listen to Eaten Alive, I'm not getting a vibe that I get from Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins about the homelessness crisis. Do you know what I mean?
No, and I think I'm being too hard. I'm just being hard on myself. I just worry that, like anyone, I suppose, you think, constantly worry that you've become detached from your own perception and your own sensibilities about it all, you know.
So you've always been quite clear about the division of labour in Sleaford Mods, really straightforward. Yeah. You do vocals, yeah. Andrew does music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it porous at all? Like, what I wonder about sometimes in a setup like yours is, can he ever turn around and say, you're not having that lyric, I'm not having it? Or can you turn around and say, that beat's just not right?
I think Andrew might disagree with some stuff. He never says anything, and I don't sit down and go, are you all right with this or that? Because I would assume he'd pipe up. But I think perhaps that's my mistake. And moving forward, I want to try and have a bit more of a different relationship and perhaps talk about these things more, because I dress the album's content, obviously, with the lyrics and the theme of it. Sometimes, does he like it? I think he does. Yeah, I think, he's not stupid, Andrew, and I think he'd pipe up. And he's quite a scary character when he wants to be.
Right, really?
Yeah, because he can just be like, fuck off, I'm not having that. And it's like, but I think he's okay with it. I think everything so far is all right, you know.
So who's playing kazoo on OBCT?
Me.
Ah, you're not treading on his toes there.
Well, a lot of the stuff that goes into it, like the drill, like the keyboards, the type things, and the dramatic, they're all my ideas.
Right, okay.
But he'll play them. Apart from the kazoo, that's the only... everything else he plays, the bass and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, you know, just the little filly bits are usually, what about this? The piano at the end of that? Yeah, okay, all right, we'll do that. And he does it all, you know, and it's his touch. I couldn't do it without him, to be honest. So
there's been some good records with kazoos on it. There's an Aphex Twin album with a kazoo on it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the track Logan Rockwich on the Richard D. James album has got kazoos and Swanee whistles. New Face in Hell by The Fall has got a kazoo solo.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Oh, that's bollocks. Oh, God.
Sorry, man.
Oh, no.
Well, that's like a good company to be in.
Yeah, well,
it is,
yeah. But, you know, it's go, oh, you fucking ripped off Fall of Fortune.
Oh, no, no.
Do you know, no, not you, but you know, people, you come, yeah, oh, all right, whatever. I didn't know that. It's interesting. I was obviously, you know, I wasn't kidding myself that I was the first person to ever use one, but it just really did sound good with Andrews, because he sent me that tune through and I thought, it sounds like The Mission or something. And I remember being in my living room going, wah! Thought, I'm doing that, I'm having that. And then I thought, what can we do for them filly bits? And, you know, it just sounds like a whoopee cushion crap, you know, someone farting, or, you know, just a dog going, yeah. Thought, yeah, I'll have that, you know, try and get, you know, kazoo's kind of suited it.
When you have these really, really brilliant kind of, and they're not surreal, but it's the opposite of surreal, because it's like really every day or whatever, but when you suddenly decide to have as part of the rhythm track, that beep you get when you step into a news agent's.
Yes.
Like, where did that, you know, is that, does that come from you?
Yeah, it did. Well, I don't know, actually, no. No, that, I think that one came from Andrew. Because he was like, it was a trip to Spa. And we were sat there and he was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You want to have, you know, when you walk in the shop and it's like, you know, the door goes. It took us 3 days to find a decent sample. He was asking everyone online and everything, and I think he finally got it. No, that was Andrew. That was a stroke of, you know, that was a real stroke of genius. I hate that word, but you know what I mean. It's, yeah, I thought that was just brilliant. Yeah.
So while I've got you as well, there's just a few things that I'd kind of like wanted to ask you about. And when I hear the word mods, you know, I think what I'm thinking at the back of my head is, it's like a young, well-dressed couple.
Mm.
It's 1964.
Sure.
They've got all the killer black R&B 7-inches from America.
Uh-huh.
They've got all of the best kind of vocal reggae stuff and all the best ska 7-inches. And they've got really killer clothes from Savile Row or maybe even imported from Italy.
Uh-huh.
If I think about a mod in 2019, I'm thinking about someone with a Fred Perry top stretched over a beer gut,
yes,
and they're listening to the Cortinas or the Libertines.
Uh-huh.
That's not very modern, is it?
No, it's not.
If we're talking about mods being these kind of modernist people who have really good cutting-edge taste, who are the real mods in 2019?
People in the drill arena, perhaps. You know, obviously, you've got the ultra violence that goes with that, and it's obviously very political. But so I guess so were the early 60s mods, the working class mods that stormed Brighton Beach. You know, you've got scooters, they've got a code. The music's got a code. And they are, you know, for one, quite smart in their own way, I think.
They've certainly got all the latest gear.
Yes, and so I would attribute that kind of a culture to that. There is still something appealing about the person with the Fred Perry beer belly listening to the Cortinas. Although I don't listen to the Cortinas, I don't like Fred Perry, and I ain't got a beer belly, you know. But I've got a little bit of a sympathy for people like that. Although at the same time, there's lots of room for criticism. With political beliefs, with the fact that it's a set of tastes that are stagnant. You could talk about that all day, but yeah, I mean, I can't help but think, well, you know, it winds me up, but at the same time, it's like I can understand it in a way, you know.
My aunties, or two of my several aunties, used to work for British Rail in Liverpool in the 60s and 70s, and I was like obsessed with the British Rail logo.
Sure, yeah.
Always wanted to ask you how you came to have it tattooed on your forearm.
Well, I don't know, I just liked it. I saw it on, what you call it, well, it's the pre-new, but it was the band before them, and I keep forgetting what they're called.
El Brutus.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Their logo on it, which was created by Scott King, I think. He kind of bought that in for it. Well, and I always, you know, there was one, he'd done it in a lot of various prints and colours, but there was one I saw, it was just black and white with a white background with, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to have that, and so I thought I'd put that on my arm. And then, you know, 3 weeks later I saw Damon Albarn with a t-shirt with it on. Oh, for fuck's sake. Yeah, so
all the Quiet's merch, it's got all our office mugs, have got the
oh really
yeah, yeah,
oh
yeah.
okay.
So you used the symbol on the front of your book, Grammar Wanker, didn't you?
Yes, yes.
Like, obviously, this is maybe another subject for a totally different podcast, because you've done a lot of writing, a lot of poetry, a lot of kind of short stories and stuff like that. I mean, I guess what I wanted to ask you to wrap up is like, you know, you obviously spend a lot of time just being a writer. Where does the boundary between lyrics and poetry lie?
With lyrics, I mean, with the short stories, I found I could get more out. I mean, I said that about the lyrics, to be honest, you know, back in the day. I found that doing rants, I could get more out than just your basic verse, chorus, bridge formula that you get with pop songs, you know, guitar orientated stuff or whatever. But yeah, I just found that I could get even more out with a short story and totally play around with the kind of absurdisms or surrealisms or whatever that come with a lot of Sleaford lyrics, you know. But also concentrate on various times and experiences that have, you know, moulded and influenced Sleaford Mod songs. I could just write about that one subject in a short story, you know, and dive into the memory of that and explore it even further. And what I liked about that was that I'd go back to some of these places to kind of get more inspiration for the story, whatever story it was, you know. And I really enjoyed that as well, just walking around taking pictures of wherever, you know, whether it be the corner of a street or a park or a graveyard, you know. And it would take me back to those times, and I really did enjoy the process of it, you know, for those two books that I did. It was really good.
Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Best of Times podcast with me, John Doran, brought to you by Lush and the Quietus. This podcast was produced and engineered by Andrew Payne and co-produced by Matthew Shaw. The theme music is by Oh The Guilt. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, give us a star rating, tweet about us, and tell your friends and family. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with more Best of Times.